Thanks, Chris. Good talking to you.
And everyone else, stay tuned, because I'm going to be talking with John Helmer after the break about what's going on in the Red Sea and how Yemen is the one country, the single country in the world standing up to its obligation to stop genocide, and it's being vilified and now militarily attacked by Western countries, including this one, Canada. Thanks again, Dimitri.
Take care, Chris.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle has taken you for walks in the park, but that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday. Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, New Zealand's ending of its funding to the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees, deserting the people under fire there at their most dire hour, makes 13, no count that 16, the number of nations enacting that infamy up till today. The Kiwis enjoin Australia, Austria, Canada, Finland, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Netherlands, Switzerland, the UK, and of course the leader of the damned, the United States of America. But more than standing on the global stage and spitting in the face of justice and humanity, some of these same are waging a war against Yemen, the one country fulfilling its obligation under international law to do its utmost to stop a genocide. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia, principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears. Helmer has too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out, and his latest released autobiography, Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes. John's recent article at Dances with Bears, Russian Foreign Ministry Ties Red Sea Blockade to Gaza Blockade, Backs Houthis in Moscow Meeting, explores Russia's delicate balancing act in the region. Welcome back to the show, John.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, John, before we get to the Red Sea, you've got another article out behind the writing of my script here, Breakthrough on All Fronts Ahead of Schedule, regarding Russia's war plans. The war between Russia and Ukraine is still going on, if people hadn't noticed. What's happening?
What's happening, Chris, is that the Russian forces have changed their tactics and are now advancing in different positions and different fronts along the line of contact with the Ukraine. And the Ukrainian military are collapsing in several different positions. So what's begun to happen is a collapse along the line as the Ukrainian military retreats into hastily prepared rear defensive positions. They're moving back towards the west. The piece describes this as a modest turning point, modest in the sense that Russian strategy has been to minimize Russian casualties and destroy the capacity of the Ukrainians to mobilize reserves from the rear, bring up military equipment that they're importing from the United States, destroy the fuel capacity, the electricity, and all of the infrastructure that activates and sustains their military line. The presidential election, Russian presidential election, will be a two-day affair between March 15th. Reasons. President Putin does not want any military disaster, any serious increase in casualties. The idea has been tactically artillery barrages and facing what Zelensky and Zaluzhny, the two competing Ukrainian commanders in Kiev, have been throwing at the line in order to advertise their dire need for more money and more arms, which those two convert into private offshore bank accounts and enrich themselves and their factions. So those factions are starting to fight it out, a last-ditch political fight in Kiev. Everybody can see that. In what country does a president fire a general and the general tells him, no way, That's the way it is now in Kiev. But on the line, the way it is that there are fewer and fewer Ukrainian officers left. There are fewer and fewer combat-trained men left. You can't train even an elderly recruit taken off the streets of Kiev or wherever in the time they need. They're being run to the front and they're being destroyed. The casualty rates are unusually high, between 700 and 1,000 a day, and the Russian Defense Ministry reports show by discreet wording that they're moving forward in various positions. It's not a massive offensive of the kind that you might think or people think when they watch movies or imagine the way the World War II was fought, or even the way the Israelis say they can fight, which they can't. We'll come to that later. But it is the beginning of the Russian offensive, the beginning of the breakthrough that has long been anticipated and carefully, let's say, staged by the Russian general staff. That's what's happening.
It's been long promised, that's for sure. Now, there was an attack on Sunday at the Sunday market on the 21st of this month in Donetsk that killed 25 and wounded 27 or so people. Does that qualify as an embarrassment? And do you think that has anything to do with what Russia is doing right now? Because these movements are emanating from the Donbass region. I mean, why at this late date is Ukrainian artillery still able to blow up Sunday markets in Donbass?
I wouldn't use the term embarrassment for such a vicious and terrible strike. But there's no question that if you've got a highly mobile artillery unit with the range, the Ukrainians are doing it. And they're doing it to advertise their capacity to so-called fight and resist, which in turn is best described as an advertisement for more money, more arms, as we said. The capacity of the Russian air defense to shoot down or neutralize drones and missiles is not in a position to neutralize an artillery piece. The Russian commitment is, after all this time, to drive those weapons out of range. And that episode, that incident, emphasizes the work that's still to be done. So what must happen, and we've been describing this on guerrilla radio for quite some time, is the formation of a demilitarized zone, a DMZ, as we used to call it in Korea, which is so deep that no such weapon can penetrate in order to strike Russians. There'll always be Ukrainian terrorism. Ukrainian terrorism has been a feature of the Lvov Banderite faction for several generations. These are serious attacks, and the only way to neutralize them to protect the Donbas is to create a demilitarized zone over which they can't cross. Second, to what will happen is a significant set of strikes encircling the remaining Ukrainian forces on the line, and they will be destroyed. That will then determine which cities, Kharkov, Odessa, Dnipropetrovsk, Poltava, and so on, remain Ukrainian or will go over to becoming Russian. What the future is for Kiev depends on what happens between Zelensky and Zaluzhny, and that will essentially leave the Ukraine a Polish front based in Lvov, pretty much with the borders that the German army established during their invasion between 41 and 43 until they retreated back to Germany.
Well, we've seen a lot of talk about the depletion of materiel from the West, certainly, but also personnel for the Ukrainian military. It's been ongoing. In your article, you say that the attrition of officers there, they're getting to the point they can't possibly replace them. I don't know how many Western nations are supplying either continually or beginning to, depending on who you listen to, officers to fill those roles or not. But it seems that if we believe the reports, there's not going to be anybody left on the Ukrainian side to fight. Are these figures, do you think, correct or hopeful thinking on the Russian part?
The Russian military doesn't engage in hopeful thinking. The last one who did that was Yevgeny Prigozhin, and he was he stopped talking about that, as we all know.
Yeah.
That's wishful thinking. That was commercial thinking. That was greed on his part, and it's over. The Russian General Staff has a daily bulletin, and it describes with guarded terms what's happening, and it's generally more accurate than anything on the Western side. What can I tell you? It's mind-boggling for listeners, and me too, to go through all of the tactical reports that are available, most or all of them in Russian, and then they're chopped, cut, and pasted by various Americans who claim to have had U.S. Marine Corps or U.S. Army experience, and they make money podcasting or writing and asking for subscriptions so that they'll sort out what they've read from the Russian sources that's happening according to their U.S. Marine Corps, U.S. Army manuals. What's happening is essentially happening in the same way in the Middle East. And the bigger picture is, and this is very important, never mind being mesmerized by the tactical maneuvering, the United States and its allies are losing two major wars, the war in Europe against Russia and the war against the Arabs and Iran in the Middle East. And we're not even getting to what's going to happen in East Asia over Taiwan and China. What's happening on the battlefield in Europe and now on the battlefields of Yemen, Palestine, and the Gulf states is that every U.S. air defense weapon is being defeated and neutralized. That means that all of the states that deploy U.S. air defense, whether CRAM, a kind of Gatling gun arrangement to shoot down incoming drones, or Patriot missiles to cope with incoming aircraft or missiles, these very expensive U.S.-supplied air defenses have failed. They've been neutralized. They've been defeated, first on the Ukrainian battlefield, and then last Sunday, early hours, they were defeated at the so-called Tower 22 base in the northeastern corner of Jordan. Let me emphasize again, this has never happened before. A country that depends on the United States in the U.S. alliance, let's call it NATO or another one, for the air defense, for ground defense, for defense against the new forms of drone warfare, those countries have to accept now. They're putting out billions of dollars to Washington and the U.S. military complex to defend themselves against weapons they can't defend themselves against, whether they're Russian or Chinese or Iranian. The methodology, the science, and the tactics and strategy of warfare have changed, and they've changed in such a way to change the fundamentals of the balance of power in Europe, and it's happening in the Middle East. That's the big picture.
Well, let's hope it changes on Wall Street, too. I don't know that these companies that are making so much money selling this materiel are seeing a loss of their bottom line. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with John Helmer. John's a journalist and author. He's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears, and he is the author of many books, including Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, Sovcom Plot, How Pirates Tried to Capture the Treasure of the Russian Seas and Were Caught Out. His latest is Dunce Upon a Time, A Life of Mistakes, his much-awaited autobiography. Okay, John, let's switch over to the Red Sea then and talk about it. You've got your article up, Russian Foreign Ministry ties Red Sea blockade to Gaza blockade, backs the Houthis in Moscow meeting. We talked the last time in late December, John, about how the Houthis determine which Israeli-connected ships to target in that battle of the Red Sea. But last week, I don't know what happened. A Russian tanker was hit.
A Russian tank, Russian oil tanker, a tanker carrying, I think it was called the Achilles, was carrying Russian oil, and it was targeted. It wasn't hit. The vessel that was hit, I'm suddenly not, articles are too far away from my memory, so I'll have to look up the name of it. It was hit and set on fire. Yes, that happened.
But it was carrying naphtha.
It was carrying Russian naphtha, correct. Thank you for reminding me. It was carrying Russian naphtha from Morocco, where it was first delivered from Russia, possibly blended with Moroccan naphtha, and carried by the trader Trafigura to a destination in India. And it was hit. And one of the store holds, the holds containing the naphtha, was ignited by the hit. Yes, that's what happened.
The ship was the Marlin Luanda.
That's right.
The one that was hit. Now, but according to our previous conversation, were either of these ships ones that we would expect to be targeted by the Houthi?
Well, I think the Marlin Luanda is an interesting case because its real ownership is not the one that you see broadcast. What happens here, and imagine you're a Houthi commander, the difficulty is this. The Marlin Luanda is a petroleum products tanker. It's come through the the Suez Canal from Morocco. It's headed towards Singapore. That's right, I think. And as it goes down the Red Sea, it's requested to identify its cargo, its ownership, its source, and its destination. If the vessel fails to answer, then the Houthi command structure has referred to its database, and the order goes fire or not fire, remembering that the Americans and the British and the NATO allies, so-called, the little Italians, the little French tagging along with their staff officers from Australia and Canada sitting in Bahrain, are already trying to figure out where the Houthis will fire from. So everything has to be done very quickly. Mistakes can be made up and down both command and control chains, the Houthi and the American one. But in this particular case, if Marlon Wander's crew failed to answer, they were going to be targeted. Most all of the Chinese vessels or Chinese-bound cargoes or Russian-bound cargoes answer no Israel connection. In the Marlin Luanda case, it's been published, it's British-owned, Oceanics Proprietary Limited. That's baloney. It doesn't require much, and the Houthis can clearly do it, to discover that the Oceanics is owned by J.P. Morgan, one of the investment funds of the U.S. Investment business through a Luxembourg front. So it's a U.S.-owned vessel. That's what it is. Should it have been attacked because it's a Russian cargo? It was up to Luanda, Marlon Luanda, to declare. If they didn't declare, they were trying to run the gauntlet. Fire. That's what happened. Well, other hand, the Achilles should have declared itself, clearly, but it didn't. But we don't know. We don't know the tactical situation. We do know Houthis ask the questions. Customs officers often do. You know, declaring? Red corridor, green corridor. Want to go down the green corridor? Tell us what you got inside. Everybody knows that at an airport, don't they?
Well, America's Central Command, CENTCOM, says, quote, neither the vessel about the Marlin Neither the vessel nor its crew have any affiliation to Israel. The Houthis have fired indiscriminately into the Red Sea, targeting vessels impacting over 40 countries around the world. They clearly, the Americans, don't see themselves as connected to Israel then somehow. But why would a Russian shipper choose such a compromised vessel? I mean, surely they must know that they're running a risk of losing their cargo if they're using ships like the Marlin for their transshipment.
I think I can answer that one quickly. The Russians sold the cargo to Trafigura. Trafigura is operating the vessel and running the cargo. Now, exactly what the terms of contract of sale are, I don't know. Sometimes the trader is acting as a go-between on consignment. In that case, you could say the cargo still belongs to the Russians. But my guess is not this time. Trafigura is responsible. Now, if Trafigura headquarters in Switzerland, not the most transparent country, and definitely not the most transparent accountable trading company. Oil trading companies like Trafigura are famously silent, secretive, and from a U.S. point of view, lawbreakers, sanctions busters, etc., etc., etc. Anyway, it's Trafigura's cargo. It's Trafigura's shipment. Trafigura bought at X from the Russians, and we're going to sell at X plus 10, 15, 18, 20% in Singapore. That's the deal. Marlin Luanda, a U.S. vessel-owned vessel, was the carrier. If Trafigura said more than we're concerned for the safety of the mariners on board, baloney. They're only concerned about the safety of their profit. If Trafigura's instructions to the master of the vessel ignore any communication from the shore, Trafigura, caused what happened.
Well, now, John, at your website, and again, it's Dances with Bears or johnhelmer.net, you had a headline up a few days back or maybe last week about, I can't remember the exact title, but regarding the fence sitting going on in Russia. Now, the recent one, Russian Foreign Ministry ties Red Sea blockade to Gaza blockade, backs Houthis in Moscow meeting. Now you're saying that Russia seems to be firmly gotten a cheek off the fence and has come down on the side of the so-called axis of resistance. So what does this mean then for, I guess what's going on in Syria and the Russian assets in that area, but for the whole region now, how far does this Russian support promise to go?
Well, it's a fair question. It's not so easy to answer. If a country, and in this case, the only country I can genuinely claim to be on your program to talk about, if Russia is running a multi-directional approach, talking out of several mouths and using different hands at the same time, that's not unusual. The president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, and the Kremlin have made one clear line, and I've tried to describe it. It's come under some criticism inside Russia, bearing in mind that we're in a presidential election campaign at the last stage. And to many people, President Putin appears to be excessively pro-Israel. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the General Staff, the Defense Ministry, and the Foreign Ministry appear to some people, many people, to be more balanced and more, let's say, pro-Arab and pro-Iranian. Now, you need to see that each of them are talking at different constituencies and reflecting different views about what the Russian national interest is. And I better add what the article adds, is the Russian state oil exporters, gas exporters, energy exporters, and the state banks that support them. What there is in Moscow, which is very difficult for the Western press and all those US CIA veterans that you can see on podcasting, or all those former US Army colonels and majors and privates who broadcast for money. What they don't understand, have never understood, and will never ever understand. This is an ad for the Napolitano gang. Don't bother with them. Why? Because they don't understand how Russian politics work. They do not understand. They don't understand very well how Washington faction politics work. But in Russia, what happened last week was that a Houthi delegation goes to Moscow, meets with the foreign ministry. At the same time, a kilometer away, a major delegation of Iranian security officers and staff meet as the Iranian National Security Council with their Russian counterparts, the Russian Security Council. What the two groups are doing is forming, on the basis of Russia's new treaty or agreement, strategic agreement with Iran, a framework for cooperation at all levels on all issues: trade, transportation, logistics, military supplies, sharing of intelligence, and so forth. The objective is very clear: to remove U.S. bases, occupation, and dictation in the Arab states, the threat to Iran, and the role that Israel has played as a strike force for the U.S. and the British interests against the Arabs since 1948. And we have now an Israeli war of genocide in Gaza and an Arab and Iranian resistance all around, on all fronts in the Middle East. Now, what has happened is that you have clear signs of cooperation and collaboration with Iran and the Houthis in Moscow on Thursday. Not reported in the West. Okay, it's not reported, but the reality is the following Sunday, known in the Western press as Iranian-backed X, but an Arab group probably of Iraqi origin, managed to break through, successfully defeat the U.S. air defense of a major 320-man-on-woman base in northeast Jordan, thereby threatening all U.S. bases. That group then announces they are suspending attacks on U.S. bases, Al-Tanf in Syria and others in Syria and Iraq, to give the Americans the opportunity to negotiate a rapid withdrawal of their forces. This is profound. This is strategically significant. Will the U.S. agree with the Iraqi government, as they've been discussing, total withdrawal of U.S. troops from occupied Iraq? If that happens, the bell is tolling for U.S. withdrawal of troops from Syria. If that happens, the bell is tolling for total withdrawal of U.S. troops and Air Force equipment and aircraft, F-15s, from Jordan. Wait a minute. What the hell is happening? Can you imagine that by acts of resistance, offensive, defensive, the acts of resistance, which starts with Hamas in October 7, continues with Hamas and Hezbollah on the northern front, the Lebanese border, continues in the west and in the east and in the south, doing something inconceivable a few months ago?
Well, the Americans have promised, or at least Biden has had a veiled threat against perhaps Iran, saying the Iran-backed, as you say, forces responsible for the Tower 22 drone attack in Jordan. John, we're fast out of time. I urge you all to johnhelmer.net, Dances with Bears, to find out more. You're not going to find information like he has anywhere else. I can guarantee you of that. It's always a joy to speak with you, John. Thanks a lot for coming on again today, eh?
Thank you for having me, Chris.
And also thanks to Dimitri Lascaris watching what's going on with UNRWA. And he, remember, promises that he's going to be a part of a legal challenge to Canada and to those that are complicit in the genocide in Gaza. We'll find out more about that, but I don't have time for that today. Till the next time. Thanks, Jordan.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.